How about a little, a little comfort food? Here to talk with us about entertainment guilty comforts, writer Colin Fleming joins us. Hello, Colin.
Couple quick questions for you in succession, sir.
Yes.
Are you hot, sticky, sweet from your head to your feet? And, more importantly, are you getting it?
Can I say one of those two? And you have to figure out which one.
Oh, yes. Just give me the double affirmative, sir.
Ah, yes, indeed. Nothing like a little Def Leppard to pass the time on a Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah, fair enough. I was thinking about what you mentioned there, guilty comforts, as I call them. And I thought as I was listening to Def Leppard's Hysteria in the cafe the other day that that would certainly qualify as one. But then it's one of those interesting things about guilty comforts that you think like, oh, this is rubbish. It's not very good. Don't really want people to see what I'm up to here. You can sort of have these little epiphanies where the thing that you thought that way about is actually quite wonderful. And I was sort of knocked backwards to realize that Def Leppard's Hysteria is as good as it is. Like, it's really one of the best rock and roll records I've ever heard, which I wasn't expecting upon revisiting it. You can even hear this hip-hop influence, like Def Leppard in 1987, way ahead of their time. And it's sort of presages the Stone Roses debut album, but yeah, it just got me thinking about guilty comforts and the range of them that are out there.
Well, and isn't that the way with a lot of them, that because we liked something when we were young, maybe we assume that it's not the quality of those things we like when we get a little older, but then you go back and revisit and you recall why you loved them in the first place.
Well, young Colin didn't bow down to the leopard, so it was more later in life that I came by that. But certain things, it's like, I know that some of the things that I like are actually quite bad. And given some of the highbrow topics we discuss on here and that I cover in my writing, it might surprise people to know that I could be sitting there in my nighttime uniform, and I completely judge people who say they do not have a nighttime uniform. Mine is shorts and a raggedy Rockport t-shirt. And I could be watching Family Guy. I could be watching Last Man Standing. Now, Last Man Standing is not a good show, but I just like it because it's a rough patch in life for me. And the people on the show seem to like each other, and they're happy, and they have a nice house. And it's just a way for me to kind of be like, huh, well, maybe someday you can have your better version of these things in your real life. It's not, it's kind of a crappy show. And it is something that is homey. It just feels comfortable. I cannot sleep without something on. And that show has to be something that doesn't have explosions, that's verbally based, that involves people in some kind of home that, like, I wouldn't mind hanging out at for a while. It's like, oh, it's sort of a nice place. People are talking. There's a bit of verbal flair. There's some wit. And it's just, I don't know, it's winds down my blood pressure a little bit along with the teas I drink, and it's just comforting.
Well, maybe someday you'll live in the kind of home where you could have Bob Uecker working for you.
Yes, Mr. Belvedere. That was one of the ones when I was a kid when it was a happier time for me, but I just remember liking that show and thinking at the same time that I enjoyed that show. It's like, this isn't exactly right Shakespearean theater. It's pretty daft what's happening here in this program, but I liked it. I can watch a show, like a given show of a show, 37 times in a row where I know every single line, because it's like, that's kind of how our relationships can be sometimes. Like, we know every single line. It's not like your buddy is Socrates for the most part. It's probably like just some normal person, and you have a history together, and there's a familiarity there. It's like that well-worn old brown shoe, to use like a George Harrison phrase. And yeah, Mr. Belvedere, I was roped in by the theme song, which was funny and boisterous, over the top. And I didn't realize at the time, it's like you realize it later, it's like, Bob Uecker, you're really bad at acting. Like, what are you doing? What was some sort of like production meeting where they said, you know what we need? We need Uecker. He's the guy. It was sort of like this like low-level like celebrity, but probably like the biggest celebrity you can be as a play-by-play guy, I suppose. I mean, you can't really think of many other. I know you like Ned Martin, but I don't think anyone ever pitched Ned Martin to like helm Alf, right?
Different show. Different show completely.
I would love to have seen that, though, I think.
I would have been all about that, right. And I actually think that he and Alf was, so far as aliens go, well, so far as people on Earth go, fairly well-read. So I think, like, Ned Martin could have done a Hamlet reference and Alf would have nodded along sagaciously, which would have been pretty enjoyable. I probably would have been the only target demo for that, but I would have appreciated it. So I like that. I like a lot of bad things. I like Two and a Half Men because they live near the sea. And there's a lot of kind of verbal back and forth that's featuring cleverly turned phrases. Now, that sounds like there's no way that could possibly be true. It's just supposed to be so disgusting and everything. But if you listen to it, it's all puns and plays on words like irked, which really is more befitting Frasier. And it's just that kind of calming. I mean, I like Christopher Cross. If Christopher Cross comes on, if I ever go to a mall again, I'm pretty into getting drunk between the moon and New York City. I remember hearing that as a kid thinking, like, what the hell is this about? Why? How logistically could that even happen? Like, you're on the Great Space Coaster, you're on, like, this ship, and you're in the midpoint in the galaxy, and you're like, I'll knock back some Merlot.
I know it's crazy, but it's true.
Exactly, right, it is. And he was so emphatic on that point that I thought, you know what? This dude might have something. I was born on a boat. He's singing about sailing. And I was into that. But then I sort of also found out the things that I thought were guilty comforts, I have recognized later to be high art in some cases. I've reevaluated certain things I was into. And then just also as culture devolves, you find that the rubbish thing that you like is like the epitome of high art. So I would read as a boy C.S. Forrester's Horatio Hornblower.
Love those. I love those as a kid.
Yeah, but they were like boys' literature, though. You know what I mean? It was what you'd read like next level up from Boy Scouts. Like, it was considered lowbrow at the time and hackneyed and everything. And there are a number of examples like that. I was into the Three Investigators books, and they actually taught me. They were like a sort of poor, not like a poor man's, but a poor that didn't have as much money, of the Hardy Boys. And they taught me a lot about pacing a story and fiction and how important it is to develop rapport between characters, because you can have whatever going on with the plot and be, oh, wow, this is so amazing. That's why I think some of the Twilight Zone episodes haven't aged well. And if it's plot dependent and it's not about hanging out, you're not going to be inviting readers back to reread what you've done, what they've already read. So talk me about that. If you like look at films from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you'll see jazz is a guilty comfort. There's always that wayward, progressive professor, right? And to show that he's not the greatest guy or his ideas are going too far, he literally crosses the tracks in the film to go to the juke joint to hear, it might be Louis Armstrong in a cameo or something like that. And another one for me was Sherlock Holmes. I was reading the other day that Sherlock Holmes, or Conan Doyle rather, was not a strong writer. And I always thought, like, okay, it's like about these two guys, it's about this friendship and everything. But if you read Hound of the Baskervilles, there is some of the most evocative passages of nature in all of Western civilization, really. It's that well written. It's Proustian in terms of the level of detail and the flow of the sentences, and what work better encapsulates what it means to be friends with someone. That's high art. That's not just a guilty comfort. So these things can evolve over time, and they've evolved over time for me.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Now, you also like Kiss, and you have a story about a woman with about a Kiss T-shirt and a woman in your building. Is that right?
Yeah. I'd mentioned that to you. I'd repressed it a bit, but I stretch it out. Back when I used to have, like, hope, I hope to have hope again someday, but back when I used to have hope, I would do things that, like, might be kind of a little creepy. I used to think I was really good, for instance, at making gazpacho, and I wasn't. I would just slice up vegetables, nowhere near as small as they should have been, and put them in, like, some sort of, like, tin and give them to some, like, new hot woman who moved into the building, thinking that this would be someday our meet-cute story. And suffice it to say, it hasn't worked out to date. I haven't made gazpacho in a long time. But I was down in the basement one time with one of these fine fillies where the laundry machine is. And she's staring at me. I'm thinking like, oh, yeah, I didn't think it was going to happen here. But if it has to happen here, I'm flexible. And I realized, though, that she was looking at my KISS, another guilty comfort for me, my KISS T-shirt. And she's just staring at me like this loser. And I just look at her and I think, I don't know why I did this. It's one of the more awkward things I've ever said. I just sort of like nodded, right? And I think I moved my hips forward a little bit and I said, they're the hottest rock and roll band in the land. It's just, we were not meant to love. I think probably that was only surpassed in terms of awkward moments by the time I got the Northwestern edition of Moby Dick, and I went up to the counter at the Borders, back when there were still Borders, and I dropped it there. It was huge, big thud, and for some reason, I started stroking the cover, and the woman looks at me, and I said, oh, yeah, time to upgrade the old edition, and that wasn't so great either. So I almost transitioned when this woman was staring at me in the basement into like some reference between Ace Frehley, and he's not that dissimilar from Ishmael, and she just left. It was probably for the best.
Hard to believe that didn't seal the deal.
I know, right? Talk about a meet cute story. If it's good enough all of these years later for me to trot out on the radio, I'm kind of triggered by this.
Oh, no, it's a story. You just don't get to tell it as part of a meet-cute thing. She's telling that to other people.
She might have repressed it herself. It
hopefully.
Odd. So it could have been one of those things. But, hey, you know what? If you listen to Alive, although I prefer Alive, too, but if you listen to Kiss's first live album, Alive, from 1975, it's pretty good. It's actually pretty good, even though they rip off the Beatles a lot. They rip off a lot of people, but a lot of people have, one guilty comfort for me when I was 14, 15 was Led Zeppelin. And I thought like, oh, geez, this is amazing. They're much better than Great White and Once Bitten, Twice Shy. But then I realized that like Zeppelin, not only did they rip everyone off, but they weren't particularly good. Like their first album was fine, but it was kind of just like loud, overdriven blues. And after that, you get into all this Tolkien and mysticism and noodling songs that go on for 22 minutes and don't really go anywhere. And they became, for me, a sort of gateway band. Like we have gateway drugs, kids, stay away from those. They're not good. But you can have these gateway bands, these gateway guilty comforts that propel you towards something richer, better. And I think they all have their uses. So when I listen to something like Zeppelin now, it's almost with that fondness for the things they moved me towards rather than what they themselves actually were.
And you're thinking, God, these guys, they were stealing from Greta Van Fleet before they were around.
The thing about Zeppelin is that the people they stole from also stole from people themselves. Like, exactly. We talk about it as though Sunhouse and Charlie Patton and Skip James weren't pilfering from each other, but they were constantly pilfering from each other. I think the fact that Zeppelin made so much money and they were four white guys and they tended to steal from black people is what created that infamy in a sense. But you can listen to, I know you don't like the song, but Run for Your Life by John Lennon is a direct rip of an Elvis Presley son single, right?
Oh, I do like the song. It just makes me uncomfortable that I like it so much.
But it's one of those things where you're in character, and it's like Raskolnikov is in character, right? You know what I mean? He's doing what he does. He's killing the landlady and all of that. It doesn't mean because you get caught up in his journey of his character that you're like, okay, screw the rent this month. I am having it out with my landlady, and I'll bring a blade. So I think there's kind of that idea of a persona that's being adopted and depicted. We too often make the mistake of thinking that the I pronoun in a song is the individual in question. And so, yeah, I just always, I was always into that kind of stuff. And I like seeing that these sort of inter-artist relationships that I wouldn't have expected to develop, that you can go from somebody like an awful band like Great White to Led Zeppelin to some understanding of a chord progression in classical music to Schubert to what the Beatles might be taking from some minimalist composer, and there's a lot of interrelation there.
So don't feel so guilty about your guilty comforts.
Well, not to pull rank on people, but I feel like my guilty comforts are like still kind of impressive. Well, it speaks, I think, to how society is devolving, that when you think, yeah, Horatio Hornblower, this is embarrassing, and my love of Conan Doyle.
Right. It's,
and ghost stories, right, from the Victorian era when people are just all about Netflix and speaking in the six same phrases. And if you showed a lot of them Mr. Midshipman Hornblower, they wouldn't understand a paragraph of it. But you're responsible for yourself, ultimately. You can't be dragged down as part of the blast with everyone else. You have to find your way, I think, to move up and to move forward. And this is one way that I do that. And now I have the Mr. Belvedere, of course, theme song lodged in my head.
Well, perhaps you should watch that and then read a little 50 Shades of... Oh, no, don't do that.
You know what? I don't know what that is. That's one of those things in life that I have purposely... The Hunger Games is another one, and I do not know who the Kardashians are. So anytime I come in contact with a mention of that, I do the adult metaphorical version of putting hands over eyes and ears. And, because, right, you can be honest with me, it probably would upset me, wouldn't it?
I probably, although I don't know either, because I had students who didn't believe me when I said I could not pick a Kardashian out of a police lineup. And the only one I did get was their old dead father because he helped out O.J. Simpson.
You could be courting disaster, though, because I could find out who these people are in these books or whatever they are and get really into them. And you'd think, oh, he's sending me this Sunday afternoon pitch thing about what we're going to talk about again. He wants to do the Kardashians again. He's unlocked some like bootleg film and he's been studying it. The man has lost his mind and I have to indulge him because, well, he comes on for free, doesn't he?
If it happens, if it comes to that, I promise an intervention.
Yeah, that's cool. I was actually thinking about you last night when I was watching something. If I was overseeing a high school play and I had a casting couch and you were on it, I would give you the role of Father Brown.
Wow. Fantastic. Thank
you. Don't you think? You could pull off that Chesterton role. I was thinking this could totally be Kimball. He's the right age. Mm-hmm. He has the right voice. You should, if you ever do that with your students, say, look, I am going to be Father Brown for this. And you're all about, like, atonement and all sorts of things like that. I think that would be a good middle-aged role for you.
I like that. I like that idea. Credit will be given in the program when we make that happen.
I appreciate that. Tithe me 10% of your earnings, and we will call it even.
You got it. Thank you, Colin. Have a great week, and we'll see you again next Tuesday.
All right. Sounds good.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown every Tuesday afternoon. Check out his work as well online at colinflemminglit.com.